see that this morning we will be continuing with the National Railway Safety Regulator Amendment Bill. Just before that, I'd like to make a few sort of housekeeping and diary type announcements to members. We've circulated a search and draft program for ourselves. And I think as we've agreed, tentatively in any case, a large time, we passed permission and got permission from Parliament to meet on that last week of our research. So that's the last week of July, beginning of August. And we put down Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday as days to meet. We might look at Thursday rather than Friday, but Thursday we don't normally meet, but there won't be caucus on that Thursday, so that members from out of town are able to touch the event, so they don't have to hang around for a Friday and not leave on a Thursday. I think we should look at Thursday, you know, and maybe the option of Friday, but definitely rather Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, that makes more sense. And then what we'll also do is schedule to meet in the afternoon as well, so we meet from 10 to 4, lunch provided. We might not need to go to 4, but we're under a lot of pressure. The deadline for people needs to spend as much time as possible. And I think it may well be possible for us to meet in the afternoon of the next week as well. On the second last line there, we said the formalization of the legal succession. I think that's the formalization of the National Land Council. And anyway, we'll sort it out. The details, we know the different decisions that we'll be doing. Okay, just so that members are aware of that. Okay. Jane, if that's okay, if we could then shift to today's discussion the Railway Safety Regulator Amendment Bill. What we did was we put out proactive letters to various obvious stakeholders. We included the two major trade unions operating in this area. And we got a response from one of them, the Parliament, saying they needed a bit more time. The additional complication was that we could only get the public address in other public responses that there might be. A week ago, I think. And so we are not poised enough to finalize. We must make sure that adequate opportunity for the public and to say what is going on. Otherwise, the whole thing will be closed down. But I'm fairly convinced that the key stakeholders are here and are active in the process, and therefore, what I'm anticipating is that we can get it very close to the finalization of the committee by tomorrow. We must obviously do justice to the process. We'll come back early for you. So we'll be a few weeks in touch. It'll be kicked into that. So we apologize for that. But yeah. Okay, so that's what we're busy with today. We're busy with looking at basically the two key submissions that we've got now from the Railroad Corporation and from Transnet. Plus, we also need to just take word with Scott. So maybe that's where we could start. Maybe we can just remind us briefly, a brief overview, just so that we refresh ourselves very quickly on the topic. Is that more, or shall we just proceed with the discussion? Let's go into the discussion. We'll find out. And I see that Transnet is up first. So that's good. So why don't you?
I am. Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much for giving us this opportunity and for your invitation to submit our comments. We submitted written comments to you on the 9th of June, and I believe that the committee members have seen those comments. explanation of those comments. So I don't think that any matters will be particularly unfamiliar to you. I'd like to introduce my colleagues on my left, Tarek Bosel and Petra Boer, who will be making a presentation with me on various aspects. And just to backtrack briefly, we did submit comments to the Department of Transport on the 5th of March, and many of those matters have been dealt with. So these comments are now really reduced to what we would like to categorize into three items. The first item is around some key definitional issues which we think need to be resolved. The second item has to do with the fee dispensation that is proposed within the bill. And the third has to do with a current investigation. And we have specific comments on each of those items. So if you'll allow me, what I'm going to do is ask her to walk us through the issues that we have in respect of the definition, which is our next slide. And then following on that, I'll ask Petra to walk us through the issues on the fee dispensation, and then I will come back at the end and talk about the investigation aspect. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Just before I start with comments on certain definitions, my colleague Petra will first attend to the first definition.
All right.
The one on dangerous goods, and then I'll...
They've done a maneuver on my side.
Okay. You didn't want to handle the damage.
They keep being passed in prison.
Chairperson, if regard is had to the current definition of dangerous goods in the Act, it refers to specific FABE standards, which is where they list these, well, let's call this for the time being dangerous goods. Now, what is being proposed now is to make reference generically to goods or substances being declared as such from time to time by way of South African Bureau of Standards. The problem that we have with that is in the industry we find it very difficult sometimes to get access to those standards. You have to buy them, so the broad public cannot readily ascertain which substances are actually listed as such. They are constantly being reviewed. At this stage, they're actually changing some of the names and numbers to notices in the Government Gazette. And we're just a bit concerned and mindful of the fact that if you refer to generically substances or goods defined as such from time to time, that there might be some confusion of what you're referring to actually. One should also bear in mind that there's a big move within the broad safety environment to refer to hazardous substances. Now, we already see some possible challenges in interpretation if the next FABE standard refers to hazardous substances and not to dangerous goods. So it is within that context that we just raise it as a contribution to assist with the drafting as well. We think it's a good idea if you can refer to it generically, but I think the practical result or implications arising from that is more problematic. And because you incorporating those references, the listing of those substances by reference, then it comes to the whole thing, can you actually incorporate something that's being developed and determined elsewhere, and it's the whole thing about the delegation of legislative power. Because these standards are not fixed, they change from time to time, and that, I think that is the real gist of our concern.
Let's approach this, since we're dealing with a few discrete items, let's zoom in on the discrete items rather than take a general presentation. If that's okay from your side, it will help us as well. Okay, what you don't do is help you raise, I think, what seems like a legitimate issue. You haven't proposed drafting for
it. Chairperson, we would propose that you refer to the actual FABE standards. And if they change in future, we have to change the law.
That's the pain in it. Because if they're changing over time, you can see how long it takes for them to approach it together. I don't think that's an exception.
Would it not be possible to propose that the legislation refers to FABS standards as determined from time to time by the FABS? There's wording to that effect, but it means that the legislation keeps pace with the Bureau of Standards modifying their standards as life goes on.
Let's hear from expert opinion. Contribute to a reformulation of that kind.
My response, Chairman, is I think that what Charles has just proposed is exactly what I believe is written currently in the proposal here. You may recall that previously we referred to SABS 0228. In the interim, it's changed to SAN 10228. So we were trying to say that, without reading all the stuff that's underlined, the standard specification of the Bureau of Standards for the identification and classification of dangerous substances and goods. That, as currently is covered in 10228. But because 10228 may change in the future to others, that's why we didn't want to specifically mention the actual specific SABS number. So I think that what was proposed now is what I think we've actually got in the current draft.
This may just require that the notion of as set by the SABS from time to time is more clearly incorporated into the drafting. I get the sense that we agree. It's just a matter of getting the drafting formulated in a way that is explicit.
So something that gives a sense that it's that all this is. Okay. So let's now revert to state law advisor. Some word that gives a sense that, I mean that are listed from time to time or something, does that seem okay and not a problem? You wouldn't use time to time, okay.
I'll look at that.
Okay, some wording that means from time to time.
I'm just trying to understand what the way time to time will be meaning. Because at any time that you have got a union, that's exactly what it means. I don't need to see the significance of the word from time to time, as long as we refer to a need that comes from SABS.
I think actually the implication of the word appropriate there actually presupposes that there will be. It will be a question of at a particular time, those standards then those substances that are referred to as dangerous goods. So I think the appropriate actually takes care of the time to time, because appropriate means at a given time.
Okay. Now we can touch what Transnet said, but Transnet would say something else as well. I mean, in the progress we can just move on from that. Let's do justice. Something else as well. What Elsie was saying is, yes, we know SABS lists these things and they change over time and so on, and that's natural, that's not a good extent. But it's extraordinarily difficult to get a sense of what it is that's been listed. So that was an additional practical issue, not so much a definitional issue. That we're raising.
Chairperson, I think to some extent it's both. If you look at the wording that's being proposed, is that the qualification is built into here that are capable of posing a significant risk to health and safety or to property or the environment that are listed in appropriate standards. And you find that the current SABS 0228 are being referred in other pieces of legislation with sometimes different connotations. You also have got your Hazardous the Substances Act, and you've got your Road Traffic Act that requires certain prerequisites when you start dealing with dangerous groups, stroke, hazardous substances. Now, because of the definition, the possibility there, and I'm not all that familiar with all the standards, is that more than one standard can then be applicable. And this is important if you start conveying some of these substances on rail. and for roads for that matter. So it's about, to some extent, about legal certainty.
Yes.
Which specific standards are, not, are you now referring to?
Yes.
And it's within that context that there are different terminologies out there in the safety environment. Some use hazardous substances as expression,
yes.
And dangerous goods has been used in this particular act. And the current name of SABS 0228 is being kept or was captured in the present version of the Act to say the identification and classification of dangerous substances and goods. So it's easy to link it and to find out exactly what we're talking about. But now what is being proposed is you're building a definition that you then have to go and apply in respect of the standard.
But what is the standard?
Well,
it's not here. That's what you're saying. Okay. Can we ask the rail safety regulator to think about it? I think it's a legitimate issue. I mean, we can see why we removed the specific reference. But then having removed the specific reference, then the specificity of what's referred to becomes unclear, and it's open to a legal answer. We solved one thing and then tried to solve another problem. We might want to, the alternative route to look at is regulation.
Without kind of making a formal kind of proposal here, a suggestion may be that the words underlined means commodities, substances and goods listed in the appropriate standard spec of the SABS for the identification and classification of dangerous substances and goods. Then we're not saying qualifying that they must also be capable of posing a significant risk to health. 10228 is based on the United Nations definition of dangerous goods, and we actually X to X what's taken from the United Nations. And so if we take out what was proposed without having consulted yet, it may be that it would address transmit concerns.
Okay, let's.
Chairperson, sorry, I'm just thinking about the solution.
Yes.
If this can be reworded to say the following, the dangerous goods needs to commodities listed in an appropriate SABS standard as determined from time to time by notice by the minister. Because what you have, the real problem is certainty, predictability, and notification. And that's exactly what the SABS don't always do. You have to phone them to find out whether there is a standard on something. Whereas they can develop it, and all that the minister does is to say from this date, SABS 10228 or 31,000 is now applicable. And then you've got both things. You've got notification, certainty, and determinability.
Okay. That sounded good to me. Would you like to say it again slowly?
I would say dangerous goods means the commodity.
That's right.
Means the commodity, substances, and goods listed in an appropriate standard specification of the SABC. As identified by the minister by notice from the debate. And that goes in the power to do that from time to time.
Right, something like that. Obviously, we need to just look and particularly the glass line to take all the good look at it. But also the department to think about it, because then the owner is on the department to rail regulator. But the rail regulator has to be the one that needs to be alert to these things. Needs to trigger the department. The department needs to trigger the minister in order to get there. But I like the suggestion.
I just want to say one thing. If the SABS made an amendment on the list of the goods that are declared as dangerous, between the time of the amendment of the list and the time of the minister to actually gather what's going to happen. This one is effective.
Real estate just has to wait. I mean, from the point of view of the rail safety regulator and central government, it's only once it's been notified that it becomes operative for our purposes, which is the reason for which the strike comes in. But it does mean the onus is on the rail safety. It becomes an important part of the rail safety regulator to invest to it, which in any case it should be. An operator out on rail isn't going to be history the yes, and remaining in dynamic context, but it's the sort of thing that we'd like to see a safety regulator do in any case.
I just wanted to find out whether, you know, for ensuring some sort of definition as it was to be more significant, that rather than just reading out all that part that talks about the closing significant health and safety in the environment is a very good thing to exclude. And I would rather put that listed product after that, because the emphasis, as I understand it, from what the rail safety regulator is here in the identification of that, is to ensure that the environment and also the safety of property is not subjected to some sort of pollution as a result of those particular goods that might be carried by the certain operator. So I'm saying that we shouldn't just throw everything up.
No, we're not. We're keeping that list.
Yeah.
So as I understood, dangerous goods means that modern stuff is improved. So I see you.
He just said substances and goods, and then from there on, But I think maybe just to embrace it, and then afterwards, as listed, by the list of years, and then identified by the minister. I just think it'd give more emphasis to the real reason behind the need for that.
Is there any specific reason? Is there any of these reasons to lead out that it has a program of significant risk? There's no good reason for
that.
No problem. Thanks. Okay, can we
move on? We'll move on to the network and network operator and chain operator definition.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In general, Transnet is in agreement with the definition of a network, but to some extent we are of the view that the definition is too broad in some respects and too narrow in another respect. The definition starts off by defining a network comprising of certain infrastructure elements, saying it's comprising of track, civil infrastructure, train control systems, and then the problem, and electric traction infrastructure. Now, it's a well-known fact that not all rail networks have electrical traction infrastructure. So the word "and" can present a problem in some instances, particularly if one looks at the definition in the narrow sense that a private siding in its own right forms a network. Many private sidings do not have electrical overhead infrastructure. So that's the first problem. But as I've said, that a network to some extent is too broadly defined, in the sense that it creates the impression that it's one overall network in the whole of South Africa. The entire railway network is the network, because it includes, it says, and any part of the following on which those elements are situated, and then it lists a number of things, railway yards, marshalling yards, etc., etc. So the question that's asked is, do these railway yards, etc., form part of the network, or does it form a network in its own right? I don't know whether it's clear what I'm trying to say. The problem then is that a network is either the overall railway network in the country as such, inclusive of all the aspects mentioned from A to F, or whether those aspects mentioned from A to F in itself forms a separate network.
Right.
for instance, the private siding, which is linked to, for instance, Transnet's lines, does it form part of the overall network, or is the network in itself a network?
I accept that the first point is valid, and I think that the solution possibly is that where appropriate, electric traction infrastructure may be the answer to that. It's not in all circumstances, but where it does exist, then it forms part of the network.
Some wording like
where applicable probably is the better English.
And then the second issue is, are we giving the impression of some huge overarching single network?
It is not the intention that we should be, and maybe it starts with the problem of any part of the following. It could be all-inclusive. It could be the Transnet Freight Rail does have yards and marshalling yards as part of the overall network, but it also could be that they are under the control of a different network operator. So we now need, and maybe the answer, I'm not sure about part being the correct word there, but after E, instead of having and, it could be or and or, which means that it's one or of them, or all of them, or then it solves that problem. So it's not a list in its totality. It can be part of them or all of them.
I think I can go with it.
Are you happy with the addition of them? Under E, we have and that tells the story that it's not.
Well, the and then opposite E, should that then also fall away?
Or should it be
all?
It could be inclusive that Transnet had all of them and it's all of them. And part of them and it's all of them.
So I think and all is around. Okay, let's again send Lord Wrighton from that. Are you? Yeah. Okay, if you look under the Roman 7. On at the line 24. E, cargo depots, semicolon. We want to make it not an necessarily inclusive list. So we want to put an all there, but it might also be an and, in other words.
Yes.
Some networks might involve all of those things, other networks might be involved. So some of them. So we want. And putting an and or is okay in a piece of legislation. You can't put that. So you must put or.
Or.
So we must put or.
Or.
Okay.
Okay.
And or can be inclusive and can, and, but doesn't. Okay. Now that's what I was wanting to say. That's what we can sometimes do outside of law, like and or.
Yeah.
Thank you. So we didn't have anything with that. Okay, we might be good
progress. Have we resolved then that the and at E will also become or?
Yes.
So there are three proposed amendments. The first is the and will change to where applicable. Where applicable electric traction infrastructure. And then the line portion will start off with or, any part. And at E, cargo depots or stations.
Okay. The suggestion was where appropriate, instead of that first and, but is or a problem? Neither.
Or where applicable.
Think about it. Don't necessarily rush a decision, but let's say we'll either put in just a substitute to and with an or. Or
Chairman, I think that this is where it becomes legal subtleties. For me, it's okay, but
we just do it right away. Quite as well, don't worry.
And where applicable.
Yeah. Any part of the following.
Yes.
Okay.
I can't get. State Law Advisor, what we're suggesting, oh, sorry, I keep calling you State Law Advisor because I've forgotten your name. I apologize for that. And where applicable.
Any part.
That's okay, huh?
So we've got two and where applicable then in the sense.
No.
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 One and.
And we put or after the E. Okay. Yeah, let's make sure we've got our ducks to do it. I've seen the ducks. Okay. Not in part, you know, obviously we're moving towards finalization. If we have second thoughts or whatever and realize we've still got a bit of time, but let's, you know, what we're wanting to do is get as close as possible to finishing it. Now we're getting to network operator.
Network operator. It's defined as means the person or persons who have the ultimate management accountability. You know, with all due respect, I don't understand the difference between ultimate accountability versus the ultimate management accountability. Perhaps if we have a better understanding of what is ultimate management accountability in this context. But the aspect that we think does not address reality is the last portion of the definition, starting off with, and for the authorization and direction of the safe movement of rolling stock on the network. We sit with a practical situation that, for instance, SARCC, a network, or let me rather say, metro rail trains and transit freight rail trains run on each other's networks. And in some instances, even on the SARCC network, the train control is done by Transnet and not by SARCC. So all we are saying is the latter part of the definition does not reflect what happens in practice. And therefore, perhaps one should look, perhaps once again, of changing the word "and" to "all."
The "and" that we need to change is the one at line 32. After thereon.
Correct. Mr. Chairman, the definition defined, and there are certain attributes or certain functions undertaken by the operator which qualifies it as a network operator. Now, as I said, the ultimate management accountability, perhaps we need to traverse a little on that. For the safety of the network or part thereof, including the proper construction, maintenance, integrity and operation of the network and compliance with the operating standards of the rolling stock. Now, that is normally undertaken by the network operator, and we are happy with that. The only problem in practice is that, as I stated, that in many instances, I think particularly, and my colleagues from Metro Rail SARCC can assist us with this, I think, for instance, in the Durban area.
Yes.
Freight rail trains run on SARCC network,
yeah.
But and also vice versa sometimes. Yeah. But the train control is then undertaken by another network operator.
Yeah.
As long as in practice, they all know what they do.
Just like we've got a similar situation in the Eastern Cape,
yeah,
where the operator is the Eastern Cape government. The train operator is the shelter. Station operator is ourselves.
Right.
So we provide all the services. And we've got an interface agreement that is signed between the parties.
I'm not sure, strictly speaking, if it's an or there. It could be an or, a where applicable, again, the authorization. Because there are cases where they do all of it, and in some cases where it's done by another network operator. So I'm not sure if it's legal niceties, whether it's an or where it's where, the word where applicable, again.
Okay. Now let's instead of. Obviously, we know it can be complicated out there in real life. What are we trying to do in this situation? We're trying to establish clarity about, in the case of an incident, a serious incident, presumably one needs to understand who is the network operator.
network operators. In a specific instance, there might be more than one.
That's the point.
That's
the point. Now, that's the point. That's the point. In other words, we need to make sure there's clarity in the body of the legislation.
Yeah.
And that this definition is not impeding that clarity.
Yeah.
That's the point.
Yeah.
So, do you want to say
anything? I was going to say that I think the key problem, if we take the implication of it, that comes to mind, is the accountability.
Yeah.
Now, why could we jointly and severally accountable? Because there are certain aspects of, say, running the concession, there are safety processes, there is the network, I mean the chairman, the firmware, that has a certain amount of responsibility to do the business for that. And then on the other hand, there could be, so I think what I'm trying to say is that in many instances, you're trying to establish accountability there, the ultimate accountability, and that could be a joint responsibility of a number of parties. So I don't know whether, you know, it means the person or persons, it is in fact others, who have joint or instead of ultimate management accountability or whatever it is, try and broaden it the approach. I'm just suggesting that I haven't thought it through, but just I've heard it used in legal sense before, where one is going to be responsible.
I don't think there should be problems. I mean, as long as there's clarity on the ground as to who's taking responsibility for what aspect of network. There's the force of that. We'll come back to the ultimate matter. I refer to incidents, but it's not just incidents. Obviously, there are various responsibilities in terms of safety plans and so on. And if we look at the body of the legislation, network operators are obliged to do certain things. Putting an O in there doesn't mix that up.
Perhaps, Mr. Chairperson, if I may propose, which may address the very problem that we from Transnet have, is if we define it as follows, means the person or persons who have the ultimate management, and we will still discuss this, ultimate management accountability for one or more of the following. And then it carries on. The safety, the proper construction, maintenance, integrity, etc., etc. So any one or more of those elements can qualify a person then as a network operator.
There are different operators. So we're trying to deal with that. We're not creating different operators.
Yeah.
They are there. Now we need to have a legislation that accommodates that reality and wording there for this.
Didn't you say that you want to create patents on a when there is a particular incident, then people must not get confused to do their thing. But now, when you have this, that somebody is responsible for the construction, another one for maintenance, another one for whatever. Should an incident occur, surely nobody will be, you know, it will be clear whom to approach for that particular incident, whether it costs life or whatever. I don't know, but the other thing, what one wanted to raise is that I think it seems to be difficult to legislate or to legislate to affirm or just making ways for what is currently happening on the ground. One would be expected that the legislature creates a particularity and a clarity on accountability. And if that means that the status quo needs to be changed, and then why should it be changed?
But we're not
to actually create patterns, not confusion on when incidents occur, and then find that and push from one office to the other. You know?
Yeah, I wanted to respond to the concerns raised by the member. I referred to the interface agreement earlier on, and I was talking about the situation in the Indian case. In those agreements, Chairperson, roles and responsibilities are well defined. Right? For example, in terms of an incident on a line that is owned by a Transnet freight rail, they'll take accountability of making a point that the rail incident commander is there on time, the whole area is cordoned off, right? And the occurrence itself is managed properly. So those fears, Chairperson, I think are not necessary in terms of our understanding of the interface agreement. Also, when it comes to repair, right, and maintenance, right, take the line from Devon to Stanley. We operate trains there on a daily basis, but it's not owned by us. So anything that happens on that line, Transnet Freight Rail has the responsibility to repair and maintain. And in, also in terms of maintenance, and I'm sure in terms of incidents that would happen along the line itself. So those issues are well defined in the interface agreement.
Presumably, you are also a network operator on that system.
Yes.
And an incident might be your responsibility rather than the maintenance of the line. The infrastructure might be. And therefore, what we're not trying to change the scheme here. What we're trying to do is just regulate safety. And therefore, we're wanting to embrace all and every entity. So we want a definition that enables the rail safety regulator to place jointly and similarly to use responsibility for putting in safety plans for doing the various things that have to do. And if there's an investigation, it might involve looking at a variety of operations, typically might well be. And the main point is just make sure that we're not completing gaps. So can we agree there were two different things? Okay, we'll get to ultimate management responsibility. I'm in favor of just putting in the form of the cleaner and it does what we want. I think.
May propose that perhaps one looks at a definition similar to the one of network, trying to break it up. There are different elements that would qualify a person or persons as a network operator. So if one perhaps along the lines of the definition of network says, means the person or persons who have the ultimate management accountability for one or more of the following, : A, safety of the network or part thereof. B, the proper construction. C, the maintenance integrity. D, etc., etc. And then at the end, O, for the authorization and direction. Then any one of these four or one or five of these elements can qualify a person. And I think that will then perhaps cater for the problem that we've.
Any problems with that?
I would have a slightly different version of the same theme.
Yeah.
Effectively, there are three, in my mind, three different aspects. The one is the actual track work and everything else, the construction, the maintenance, the integrity of that. The second aspect is to make sure that the rolling stock that runs on there it falls within the standards that are specified for that railway line.
Yeah.
And the third thing is the authorization of the safe movement of the rolling stock on there.
So it's an A, B, C and not more than that. So construction and maintenance.
Construction, maintenance, integrity.
Are one responsibility and we don't divide them up. Obviously there's engineering firms that do the construction and so on, but
somebody's responsible for that.
A network operator will be responsible for it rather than the civil engineer. I think we can move on.
Thank you.
Hang on, but it's the ultimate management accountability.
Yes.
Just
can I suggest that we drop the notion of ultimate, because management accountability will actually be defined in the contractual relationships between various parties in any specific set of circumstances. And where Transnet is wholly responsible for all of those elements, well, then we are accountable. But we might reach an agreement with the SRCC or any other operator in which there are a number of arrangements in that contract that split up that management accountability depending on various elements that are suitable for the operation.
The word ultimate?
The ultimate, I think, creates the confusion.
Because you might, I mean, there might be joint, whatever, accountability for a problem.
Again, as a non-legal person, the problem that we sat with is now that we've got the three different people defined as who can be the network operator, we don't want to find ourselves as the regulator now having to find out who is the person that carries the can on each one of those aspects. The fact you have a contractual relationship with somebody to do something on your behalf, you can't contract your ultimate responsibility away. You will still remain ultimately accountable, is what we're trying to imply. Now, whether that's legally sound or not, I'm not sure. Because you can't have say to the contractor, you are now responsible for making sure that the rolling stock is safe to run on me, and just wipe your hands of it and say, I've now given to a contractor. I think that you, as the responsible body that we would now issue a permit to, would still remain ultimately accountable for that. And it's one of the major tenets in our safety management system is that you can't delegate your accountability. You can delegate certain responsibilities, but you can't delegate accountability. And that's the intention, right or wrong.
Could we manage that by referring to the permit holder rather than the person with the management accountability? So the party that is given the permit to be the operator.
It may be that in a particular aspect you've got, according to our understanding now, more than one person having a permit. One for the train operation authorization and one for the operation, the safe network. So you would have two permits, potentially two permits over one section. So at the moment we've gone away from ever talking except one point in the Act about the permit holder. We've tried to be rigorous in saying we actually recognize three groups of people, network operator, train operator, and station operator, either singularly or collectively. There's nothing to stop us now saying, okay, we're going to refer to them as permit holders here.
There's a further problem to that, Mr. Chairperson, and that is you need to first determine whether the person is a network operator, train operator, in order to see whether that entity had to apply for a safety permit.
Yes.
So you cannot, in the definition, already build in the safety permit. Yes. That's putting the cart before the horse. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I would have felt comfortable from a legal perspective if it simply read that ultimate accountability. Or the problem is with the word management. I don't understand how is management accountability different from the overall accountability.
Yeah. And in fact, it's accountability rather than management.
Correct. Correct.
Take management out.
Management.
Okay. I'm happier with that.
Yeah.
Because I thought it was the problem with ultimate, but I can see the importance of it. So that you might devolve certain will likely in contract to whatever devolve management, a variety of management responsibility. But you can't devolve ultimate responsibility for the maintenance of the infrastructure. That's your baby. Okay, we agreed on that.
Thank you. Then the last comment that we have as far as the definitions are concerned is the definition of a train operator. And in general, we are in full agreement with the definition, but once again, it does not keep track of what's happening in practice. I just need to mention over border trains, where trains from Zimbabwe or Mozambique are entering on our network, or for instance, Rofos Rail, and sometimes even where we as Transnet Freight Rail haul the rolling stock of another operator. And the problem comes in with the last part of the definition, specifically referring to including the responsibility for the maintenance. And that's the problem. Transnet Freight Rail is certainly not undertaking any maintenance for over-border wagons or for that of any other operator. Yes, we as a network operator have to ensure that the wagons are roadworthy. Once they enter the network, we need to look at the specifications, loading, etc., etc. We fully agree with that. The problem is we, however, do not undertake the maintenance of those wagons. And that's the problem with the definition we see.
What is your proposal?
We have, I think it is like we've done before in the previous one, including responsibility for the operation of rolling stock and where applicable the maintenance thereof.
Perhaps, once again, as we've done with the previous definition, Mr. Chairperson, is that there are different elements qualifying a person as a train operator. Mervyn, and as per your previous proposal, shouldn't one likewise here say the management, the ultimate accountability for, one, the safety and integrity of the rolling stock and network, the operation of the rolling stock, and where applicable, the maintenance. I'm thinking now aloud, and please assist. All I'm saying is there are three or four elements in this definition that can qualify a person, and perhaps one should do likewise and be consistent on the way you break it up in.
But the particular issue is the maintenance.
Correct. Yes.
So if we take maintenance to the back,
yes,
the of the sentence, to the end of the sentence, this operation of rolling stock forward, and then add and where applicable maintenance.
And then, of course, once again, we will propose that the word management is deleted.
Any problem with that? Okay. That's it from your side.
Thank you.
It's on the definition. Thank you very much.
All right, great. Well, thank you.
If we can move to the safety fee dispensation provision. Thank you.
This is on page 5 of our amendment.
Chairperson, I would propose to do with both clause 9 and 10 together because
yeah,
they interrelated and they link up.
Correct.
And I think our main concerns are both from a policy point of view or an approach point of view, and then also a drafting issue, one or two of those. Chairperson, I think to start off, the current provision is that only provision is made for a processing fee. And we, in our mind, read it as a one-off fee when you apply for your safety permit. You pay a fee for that particular processing. What is being proposed now in the amendment to Section 17 of the Act is three different fee dispensations. One is fees for services, as determined by the minister, then the fees determined by the regulator, and that is the clause 10 amendment to section 23, and then any other fees determined by the minister by notice in the gazette. And our concern is more that we're not clear on what this exactly means, because various implications flow from these proposals. Now, if I can start with the first one, the fee for services determined by the minister, first of all, the drafting issue is the determination of the services for which fees may be raised, or is the determination for the fees that may be raised for certain determinable services, or both. So that's the first drafting issue. But arising from that, if the minister is allowed to determine services, he may, through subordinate legislation, be actually be empowered to create new functions for the regulator.
But that isn't the intention. The intention is that, because we also added in consultation with the Minister of Finance, if I'm not mistaken, last time around. So having added that, I think it's telling us that it's about the fees and not the function.
But then
and let's just make sure that I've got that right. Mm. Before we go off on a red herring. What's intended here is the Minister will determine. That's how I understood it, and that's
yes,
why I understood us adding.
It's about the fees, not the services.
Yes. Okay, so we need to, and therefore their concern is right, it could be read undervenantly. And we've added in consultation with the Minister of Finance.
Chairperson, then it still begs the question, what
okay,
services
okay.
are we talking about?
Okay. So let's... Yeah, I agree. There's a whole lot of things that connect up. But let's then get for the big B just right, having been alerted to that. So in other words, the fund for the regulator consists of money appropriated to Parliament, through Parliament, in terms of 23.2, which we're coming to, and then... Okay, let's take them all together. Okay, so we're noting, we're agreeing that it's about the fees and not the function that the Minister will gazette. Okay. So we're agreeing, and we therefore need to maybe get the wording right. But before we even try to get the wording right, let's try and work out the next one, which is now...
What services do we talk about?
What services, and therefore what fees are we talking about? And how does that connect to the new section 10? Hello. Oh, it's one of the same things. I think we need some assistance on the horizon.
Let me start off saying we found that the current legislation limits the regulator of the sources of funding. And provision was now made if we provide a service, and let's say for a railway outside of this country, we could enjoy getting the income from that, those fees that we could charge for providing that service. So it's a fairly open-ended kind of statement, but just empowering the regulator, as is required, as we understand it now, that we must try and get closer and closer to balancing our books. So we need to kind of find ways and means of getting other income, and this was now a clause that allows us to determine over time, in consultation and with approval of the minister, the kind of services for which we can charge fees. That was the intention.
Let's fast forward then to section 10. Because the problem they let's hear the totality of what you raised.
Chairperson, just to reiterate, that is the first concern we have, is that the fees in clause 10 in 23 is a different fee dispensation.
Yeah.
But if you apply interpretation principle, the fee for services is something separate from what we have there.
Yeah.
And if I can take my cue from, because the minister published draft regulations proposing exactly such a fee structure some time ago, and the industry was allowed to comment on that, things were mentioned such as training, phoning for advice. So there is still an element of we need to know what fees are we talking about, because they're definitely not the services that we refer to in clause 10 in relation to section 23. They're something else. Then, of course, the other fees is indeterminable. We do not know at this stage what other fees may be discussed. But if we then go to clause 10, dealing with the amendment to section 23, the main thing is here that the same body determines the fee, the amount, everything. So if they can't balance their books, and I'm not being disrespectful, the bottom is they can just increase it without any checks and balances being built into the matter. And we raised it in our initial comment to the Department of Transport, and in my own mind, in the first one, I thought that this other fee structure was in some attempt to actually give effect to the checks and balances. But because they've been listed like that in clause 9, they've done something different. They're not impacting on each other.
Yeah. And so they get regulated by the minister in consultation with finance minister in one place, and then they're unregulated.
That's correct. That's correct.
In another place, and then we're not quite sure.
Chairperson, then it's a drafting issue as well. If you look at the proposed amendments to Section 23, they say include periodic fees. Now, we've got some conceptual problem with how can an application for safety permit be a periodic fee. Administration, that's something different. So the wording there is also some challenge. I think overall, if we can summarize, is that we're concerned about the predictability. Operators need to budget and prepare for certain things. So there must be some predictability from when is a fee determined, how long will it apply, so that one can prepare for that. It's not about an indifference or a resistance to paying, but you can't anticipate something that you do not know. One of my previous mentors said you can't fight that. And I think that is the overall concern that Transnet has in this instance, is that apart from the purely arbitrary and discretionary way that these fees can be determined, is that the overarching challenges and concerns, we can't predict any of these. So one day we have to pay 500 rand, the next day we are obliged to pay 2 million rand for exactly the same application, service, whatever the case may be.
Okay. A little bit of a suggestion.
Just what the current status is. I mean, are those things got it for a year, 2 years, or
three years.
So basically, we're talking about that fee for a permit for 3 years.
But the way it's been structured is that it's payable in three installments, rather than paying it all up front, it's paid annually.
Well, can you spell that out?
Sure.
The triannual application, which has to be reviewed.
Now, the application is once a year, but once in 3 years, and then every year we need an application, at least we need the annual safety improvement plan to be accompanied by a permit. The next installment of the permit.
Okay. Let's break it down into five chunks. So let's start with Section 9. We don't have money being appropriated to class five. Will be paid to the regulator in 2022. We're not saying that, but we have problems with what we might have problems with what we're going to take in 2022. Penalties, we don't have a problem with in terms of regulation. Okay. Then B for providing services by the minister in consultation with the minister of finance. We know what you're reaching for there, but as it stands, it's not different. There's a kind of miscellaneous category under small B, big B. Because again, there's the possibility of other fees. but to allow for that possibility, it would have to be suggested by the minister. The Transnet nervous about that, but we certainly from a parliamentary side, and as we don't want to just allow that possibility. Okay. In other words, they might provide services to another operator, and maybe we can involve whatever operator, whatever. that might look like a ghost to you because it doesn't say.
Yeah. I think it's more than a ghost because I referred back to the draft regulation that was anticipating these amendments to the Act. And they just said for audit fees, training, advice, as if there was no distinction in the draft regulation to external operators or people from overseas. It would have applied. As I read those regulations, and those are along, unfortunately, I didn't bring along a copy of those comments, but that would have implied that if we want training or we want advice from the regulator, we will have to pay for that. So it's a bit more because those were captured in the draft regulations already issued by the Minister for Commerce.
I don't have the copy of them either with me, but the intention there, when we talk about audits, inspections and so on, it all part was perceived to be all part of the process for issuing a permit. It wasn't about providing, not providing an auditing service per se, but because we need to audit prior to issuing a permit or inspect, there's a collective list, which I don't have, saying that that's what makes up the reason for the fee that we want to charge. That was the intention of those regulations.
Those are regular things that need to be done.
It was done in terms to determine the fee that was required to issue, to determine the charge for a safety permit. It was in the context of that. It wasn't the context
so
of
an application fee.
Yes.
And which they can fix over 3 years or something, and they have to reapply every. And then there's work done in terms of then processing that application. Is that fundamentally what you're referring to?
Currently, the bill, the Act talks about a processing fee.
Processing
fee. That's how it currently reads.
Right.
The draft regulations are intended to expand that to go beyond just the fee for processing, to amplify that, to say it includes these other elements. Unfortunately, I haven't got here to this, of which one is audit, and one is an inspection, and so on. And those were now
so
all...
Why isn't an audit or an inspection part of the process?
It was to amplify and qualify that. There was no doubt about what was included. So when you apply for a permit, you know that that's what we've included in the cost, because we now have to do certain things in the process of issuing a permit.
And it obviously couldn't be a standard chart, which would depend on if you're auditing Transnet rail operations or robots.
Correct.
You're dealing with very different scales, and therefore the process needs to be a lot more demanding and expensive.
Correct.
Plus the capacity to pay, out of that fell the waterfront.
I think one should distinguish between the application for the permit,
the
processing as contemplated in section 23.4, that's the process of issuing the permit, and then the later functions in administering the Act, or the functions of the regulator in terms of the Act. So the processing is quite different from the auditing, for instance, or investigations, etc. There are three. First, the application fee, then the cost in relation to the processing of the permit as contemplated in Section 23.4.
Which might involve an audit.
Which might involve, as per 23.4 then, but not the other audits provided for late in the Act or the investigation. So those are the three,
kinds of fee.
Correct.
And I would be in favor, so I think to clean it up so that it's subject to what they might know, to distinguish three kinds of payment fees that they charge. But technically, all of those, in my view, should be subject to some kind of regulation. So they shouldn't be self-regulated. They shouldn't set their own fees. They're in a perverse position because they're under pressure on the department to balance it. They have been not to balance their books, and why should they? They're not a commercial entity. So the pressure is coming from the divine. So therefore, it's appropriate that the Minister of Finance and Minister of Transport, which are then putting pressure on the government, can also then consider the scale, and particularly the Minister of Finance, so that we're not then imposing a damaging fee that undermines the sustainability of critical aspects of road, which is really your intention, but you might be under such external pressure to damage the world. Your key job, surely, I think we've got to take the driver of this, okay? And if you haven't quite done this book, for me, that isn't within reason, budget for that. As long as you are doing a good job as a safety regulator, that's your job. Maintaining a degree of economic sustainability helps. But you shouldn't be taking your feet. There's any reason why you wouldn't want to be. Because you've allowed for some of them to be regulated, but not others.
But you may not necessarily want to have the regulation adjusted for the fees that the regulation may have, simply because some of these fees, for instance, the processing of a safety application,
That
processing fee will obviously be from entity to entity and also annually. Because what it costs us to process an application for safety fee this year will not definitely be the price, the charge for next year. Now, if it's by way of regulation, what therefore it means is that on a yearly basis we need to be amending those regulations. And it might be a very tedious exercise. Rather, maybe what we need to include is that the regulator may determine and may, with the approval of the minister, that we only get the approval of the minister and not the publication of regulation on the kind of fees that we can charge.
Okay.
Just an interesting legal observation. Simple interpretation. Anything done by the executive must at some stage be published in the Government Gazette for notification. So, if they want to avoid that, I think then the Interpretation Act requires a notice in any event at some stage. Chairperson,
if you're getting the Minister's approval, and you need to get the approval, what makes it less long-winded than any Minister, but I mean, it's surely important to have that.
That
you are not. And if we say with approval, which you're happy with, and then the legal interpretation would have to be presented like that.
Then a notice will be converted. Because, you know, it's an easier process than having to go through the regulation where we have to publish this regulation for public comment, receive public comment, and incorporate them and all that. In the meantime, we need to be charging fees for processing and for administration of those safety payments. So these are very fluid charges that will depend year on year.
Yeah, okay, but on an annual basis, you know that you're 4 months before whatever, you put in a motivation to the department to say, you know, this is our experience, etc. We would like to motivate for the following fee structure.
Yes, for the approval and notice in the Gazette.
Yes. So you do it in good time, with 4 months, whatever it is to go, before that particular year's determination right now. And you give time, because you do want, in principle, Transnet or Rail Community Corporation, whatever, to be able to say, to be able to comment. I mean, it's appropriate. The key stakeholders and all the stakeholders should be able to comment on a fee structure so that you can make sure that it's not abused one way or another. And it's important that the department has
Jefferson, I think what is important is that we should not confuse matters, and where we want to put things together, we should realize the implications. The current arrangement, if you don't look at Section 23, is that the regulator may determine the fee for processing the safety permit application. It's only linked to the application. And when you apply for the application, that must be accompanied by the processing fee and the safety management system report. So in my mind, that's a once-off payment. Here's my application, you process it. And if you then go and look at sub 4 of Section 23, the kind of information that might be required or acquired, the things that must come to the attention of the regulator are all linked to the application. What this is proposing is a completely new fee dispensation, where it is said, when you apply for your permit or a renewal, you pay an application fee. Then you have to pay for the processing and assessing your safety permit. And I would regard that as what's currently provided for. So you must give us information about your safety management system, etc., all this whole thing. But then it goes beyond. In then the regulator issuing the permit, you have to pay another fee. Then the regulator is going to charge an administration fee, which then goes on to the ongoing management of safety, which then comes to audit, inspection, and those kind of things. So it's a whole new fee dispensation that's being proposed. And the periodic nature of some of those elements and the want of nature is, first of all, not properly reflected in our minds. Secondly, the implication thereof for companies that have to budget for a particular time in advance, and the unlimited nature of determining we want to do 5 orders on you, it will cost you 50 billion rand and your turnover is 1 million rand. So there are various implications arising from that. And that was perhaps the one positive of the draft regulations that were published, was that there was an attempt to describe the process of, very similar to your MTS process that you have in government, in preparing for an appropriation bill, that you have to go through certain things, present it, then that gets gazetted, and it only kicks in from a future financial year, and then it's consistent for another year. So what I'm trying to say is there are various elements that we're debating presently that should not necessarily be confused with each other, but they do impact on each other. And the main thing of transit is we're just concerned that we don't have clarity of exactly the funding model. Because if you then go and look at what is currently, what was proposed in those regulations, it starts working with maintenance costs. So you want to use the cost of operations of one role player to determine your own cost of operation. So there are various factors regarding the whole fee dispensation that is actually unclear to us. And that's why we didn't in this instance really propose counter-drafting or proposals, because we're not certain what exactly the model is that they've been working on, and we can only start assisting once we've got some clarity on that as well.
Okay. So let's try and achieve that this morning, rather than try to drop it. It seems to me that we were beginning to agree that there are 3 kinds of fees. An application for a permit. There's the processing of that application. And then there are issue determined interventions. Now that's where sort of a, that's what you are. And some of it would be triggered by operation. Or a concern, maybe not an incident, but a concern, a report of an unsafe security line or whatever. That's something that arose years back. It was not as an incident, but a concern. It was a question of and writing just as a general summary, simple. There are two kinds of related, but to finish it.
I'm trying to understand your third element.
Well, I think we all find out that that's the one. Okay. I mean, there's the routine process, the application and the processing of application. So those would be two categories. And clearly, there can't be just a fixed sum because the amount is maybe with the application, but with a fixed sum, but with the processing, obviously, there would be very little or huge amount. Third one would be variation, but some guidance to how the variation is based. You need lower limits, upper limits, or something like that. Not in legislation, but in some kind of regulation. And then thirdly, the other work that you do.
Operating expenses. Okay. I would say the operating expenses.
Which are hard to predict from both.
No. That's not what you have in mind here.
Okay.
Look at C. It says the subsequent administration of such payments. Here we are talking specifically about the administration of the state payment. So when does an occurrence, we are not talking about the cost of doing the occurrence investigation, definitely not. We are talking about how do we the work that we are going to get involved in the maintenance of that state payment. And to give an example here, operators are supposed to submit to the regulator on an annual basis their safety plan. That is the maintenance of the safety clinic. And they are also supposed to, if there are any changes that happen in their safety management system, then they need to be updating the regulator to say, these are the changes that have happened on the safety management system, which is at the initial stage when they apply for the safety clinic, they must give us that SMS report. Now, when there are changes that happen on the ground level, they must give us information to say, this is what has changed. So those are the things that we are talking about. Administration of the safety clinic. So not operational issues of the RSR. We are not saying when we go out there, because there's an accident that has happened, we are going to be charging the operator for. That's an accident.
You don't do that.
No, we don't.
Okay. Okay. So C seems to want to fall away. D under 10.
Yeah.
Issuing such.
Yes.
Unless it's charging postage. I think it's not wise to charge for position. I know that estate agencies find a way to charge for it. But around safety regulations, that must be in the charge, must be in the application of the process. And then there's ongoing administration, and then there are penalties. That's another source of penalties. But that's another regime. It's not a fee regime. But and that's so when an occurrence happens and you carry out investigations and so on, if you do, you look often, it's not particularly you, but you would see that in some form. Wouldn't be charging.
Chairs, I think the difference between, other than what you've now said about the C being deleted, from what is currently legislated, is that in the current legislation, the assumption was that everybody who applied for a permit would get a permit. So we wanted to now have the opportunity, and that's now C at the bottom of the page. Non-refundable application. So you apply for a permit, not, and there's a fee will be charged for that, but you won't necessarily get one, depending on what, how good you find your safety management system report. So that's one amendment that we, the reason for wanting to change the current 23.3C. Thereafter, then it's the process of evaluating, assessing, and so on, and administering those permits over the life cycle of the permit.
So you're agreeing that we knock out that one
Well, the issuing is, for me, it's just a step in the process. It's not, for me, material.
Then, once it's satisfied with it, then give you a person. One alternative to the dream is you have to have a kind of annual fee, which includes all sorts of funding. But I will amend them and advise them, I will give them a safety plan, they will do some things and all sorts. So we add money to things for 3 years. And we like to see that the reporter tries to include it, I find him once of the year. We do whatever we like to them. I want to amend it, and we want to question it. It's all issues. The ones of management fee. So maybe it's not an action fee. It's only management of the license. It's a license manual, and that's an end of it. 2 years you apply again. So maybe the action is the application, the police processing fee, and the management fee for the license.
What they believe should be considered reasonable. Mm-hmm. Now, at the moment, what is reasonable in terms of what you are charging? Is it comfortable or uncomfortable?
Okay, let's hold on to that thought, because what we're trying to do is just sort out the structure, first of all. So there are a couple of proposals. We've agreed to knock out one of the four items. The next suggestion from the commission is actually to knock out another one. Amalgamate A and B, an application and process, and then administration of what it's meant to be called administration and management. How does that sound to you, Rail
Station?
Not good.
No, you see, the application fee, it's so that we can start with the process, with the processes. So when we receive that application fee, it's so that the RSR can start processing. Now, if you want to knock out the application fee and leave it that we only do the processing and assessing, remember, when we do the processing...
No, we're not trying to knock it out. We're just saying we're calling one. But maybe you're right. But in other words, we're wanting to say there's an application and processing fee, and we're calling that one fee. But maybe that's not right.
It's not right, yes. Because okay. when you put it together, what usually happens is that your application fee, it will be just a fixed fee that is going to be paid by anyone for just submitting that application to the RSR. And so that we can start with the processing. But if, for whatever reason, then the RSR does not issue that application fee, that does not issue that payment, the issue is, do you still pay the processing fee to the RSR?
In other words, you're dealing with Rail Commuter Corporation and Transnet, that's one thing. But some fly-by-night operation, let's be more polite about it, but you know what I mean. Unlike Rail Commuter Corporation and Transnet, puts in a potentially whimsical application. And you don't want to be drowned up with a woman. So there needs to be a relatively substantive application. I mean, not so huge that the small entrance are disqualified from the beginning.
Okay.
Or it might be a large entity but running a very small operation. They're not wanting to. And we want to encourage people onto rail, so we don't want to. So that's another consideration. But you don't want to win people. So I can understand why there could be a little bit of a hurdle with an application. But you don't know what your processing responsibilities are going to be until you've begun the process, until you've begun to look at what the application is. I can understand. Now, because you've begun to do it at a time with current operators, you'll have a sense of what the escalations are. But something that's new might present you with an uncertainty. So up front, you can't allow an application to be free, because then I'll put in an application. But I shouldn't be given a certain factor. So there needs to be some cost, and you're going to have to begin the process. Quite soon you would say, if I'm going to go forward with it, the processing fee is going to be, do you still want me to proceed?
The idea
this is a very big job, and you need to understand that in order to proceed with your application, which I'm taking seriously, it's going to now cost this amount because it's going to involve this one bit. And then that becomes a second fee.
Which is what we did.
Which is what you want to do.
Yes.
And which is what you've been doing in any case.
Yes. Currently we have published the notice in the government gazette to say these are the fees that the RFR will be charging for processing an application. So they are there.
And they will vary.
And they would vary.
So that's what all of you want to say in the gazette.
Yes.
Is this the draft one that you're going to on action?
This is another notice that the RFR has published setting up fees.
They're not aware.
No, we informed the aware. We actually, what we did was, because we had a database of all the operators, we had issued applications, safety tenants for 3 years, and those were just about to expire this year. So what we did, before we even published that notice, we actually sent letters to operators to say, RFR has recommended the processing fee, this is how much we're going to be taking operators and all that. Those letters
are
sent to all operators.
Okay, let's not get tangled up, okay? They now know, okay, they've been. okay. Can we agree then that there are three kinds of fees, not two? Can we go back to the notion of three kinds of fees rather than two? An application, a processing of the application, and administrative management of the firm. Can we agree with that argument?
Yes, we have to
look at it. Transnet Happy, Rail Corporation Offshore. Rail Safety Regulators, okay. We've got one of your four. Then, how do we. Okay, so I think we. How we word all of that? Well, it's probably easy because it's basically. The next quick question then is, how are the fees determined? Currently, what we find, some are determined by the minister in consultation with the finance, and others are determined by the RSR itself. Why a distinction between them? And why should they not all be?
Even before one perhaps gets to that, is the issue of whether it's a once-off payment or whether it's a periodic payment. You see, it starts off in two, and perhaps A and B would be a once-off a payment, while the administration subsequent may be periodically charged.
Yes. I mean,
and then the
how
criteria.
You pay for those things. I mean, we don't want to get into that detail too much, unless there's some persuasive reason.
Well,
can't those also be regulated?
Well, normally an application fee is payable on the date
that
of application.
Sense.
And the processing is also once-off, because once the safety permit is issued, it's issued. But the, subsequently then, your administration with regard to your management, your safety management plan, that falls under the administration. And there you may perhaps periodically over the duration of the permit charge a fee on a yearly basis or whatever.
But do we want to put that in legislation?
It could be a drafting correction. chair, but at the moment the periodic applies to all three categories. That's really the
I see what you're saying. Okay. We could just knock out periodic. And then leave that to Okay. So role of regulator, role of minister. I'm sure Transnet and Ralph in corporate in favor of minister. You're right on that. And Ralph has a regulator.
It's not.
And there's a board you don't like.
All we've done, of course, is we've taken 23.2 and we've just, instead of having a single statement called a processing fee, we've now got A, B, and D, having C having been deleted. So in the current Act, we were empowered to determine the fee.
Yes, but is that right? Were we right in the
current? Oh, okay. So as long as we understand that we're not...
No, I understand. You're not flipping something in that wasn't there. No,
yes.
I agree. It's a criticism of our stuff. Were we right in giving you? And I think your objection is more just worried about time and delay. It's not a principled objection. So I think that. See, I think it helps you. Because if you come under pressure from the department saying, why aren't you balancing your books? Your answer is, well, because you're not empowering us to balance. So you don't sit with that baby of trying to figure out how we're going to balance our books, how we're going to what are we going to get out of Transnet and so on. It becomes the responsibility of the department to work out how you, if that's what they want, if the department requires you to balance the books, because that's where the pressure comes.
And the Treasury.
Right, and the Treasury, and therefore the response must be, well, it's you that determine the fees, not us. And we are, obviously you would have to start managing your affairs and responding to money and so on, your sources and so on, but I think it helps you rather than someone to make the determination, an independent determination.
Okay, let me come up with a suggestion. The minister must then, it must become an obligation on the minister to do it on an annual basis. The minister must determine a fee that the regulator may charge for the following on an annual basis.
So can we get wording along those lines? Okay. Hopefully we can get them. And we can look at it tomorrow.
Yeah.
Are we sort of more or less on the same page now? You don't have to make it's not a final decision now, but think about it. But unless there's some big thing that you need to stop in the funding.
Chairperson, I think you've summarized already, but if I can just put it in other words, the impact on this from the industry. Now, if you've got big role players, it's not that much. Especially with new role players, and it begs the question, are you determining these fees with reference to the monetary requirements of the regulator to perform their position? Because in that mind, I think that you do not take into account what is the ability of the industry to accommodate and fund those figures on your bottom line.
Yes.
But, and I think that is where the debate is also to some extent, as you summarised, it might be prudent to put it in a political figure.
Yes.
Because the funding from Parliament is still there.
Yes.
So, and that's what actually our question up front was, is this intended to cover all the directly related expenses to a permit? And we can capture it as, say, overall operating expenses?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it at some stage to top up the requirements of the regulator? And these are two very different funding models that we do not have any certainty. I think it's already a good step in the right direction to say the regulator did not determine it themselves. Someone else in a political figure is perhaps appropriate. But then outstanding debate, which is perhaps not even relevant to this debate, is what model did you use?
No, I agree. But that needs to be a political thing. Mm-hmm. And I think one that is taken with the active impact. It's got to be part of our vision for rail and the future of rail and sustainability of rail. But it's not something, one doesn't want to impede that possibility in legislation, one wants to facilitate it. And one doesn't want to put a regulator under so much pressure that they're starting to charge users. We're talking about a narrow issue, which is kind of balancing books, rather than a vision for what we're trying to do, and so on. So can we, I hear what you're saying, but maybe you'll come back tomorrow with another view. So I think, I agree with you, I think it's a step in the right direction. Whether a Minister of Transport is working with Minister of Finance to get it right or wrong is another matter. And I mean, that's part of the political debate and the struggle that we already. Right. Next. When we were just dropping and adding all the questions right now, so
Chairman, just a short one. In our written submission, just on the proposed sub 3C at the bottom of the page, we referred back to the non-refundable application fee. We've just proposed additional wording that the committee can look at.
Just come back. Just mind what it was.
On your page 5.
Yes.
Line 51.
Yeah.
We've actually just said we propose here that it be accompanied by application fee referred to in subsection 2A. So you refer back to what it links up to, which fee is non-refundable. So we just propose some wording.
Refer to
through 2A, whatever you do in clause 10.
Agreed. That's not another fee.
No. Just, we wanted to link it to that particular one.
Okay. And that's not a problem because the key point they're trying to make is non-refundable. Which we have. Okay. Okay, next.
Thank you. This is our last issue, and I don't think it will take as long, or I hope it won't take up enough of your time. But it refers to clause 16 of the amendment bill, and it refers to section 38 of the Principal Act. We welcome the proposed requirement to investigate all rail occurrences. In fact, from a Transnet perspective, we do that anyway. Any rail occurrence, we certainly do investigate, and we welcome that inclusion in the bill. The difficulty arises from clauses 9 to 12, in that this seems to introduce an additional investigation, additional to what is already provided in the Act in 38 subsection 1 and 2, which allows the regulator to initiate an investigation in their own right or at the request of the minister in any event. And we're not sure that it is helpful to additionally include the further investigation proposed in such clauses 9 to 12, which seems to occur at the same time as the investigation that's being undertaken by the operator into the occurrence. And we would submit that provision be removed, and that we create a statutory duty on the operator to submit an investigation report to the regulator within a defined period, and then allow for investigation simply to trigger the provisions that are already in the Act under 58(1) and 2 for the regulator to then proceed with its own investigation should it deem it necessary to do so. We found the introduction of a committee of inquiry suddenly to be a little confusing because it's the first time that notion appears.
And is that?
13. Subsection 13, so it's 38-13. In exercising its function under this section, the regulator or a committee of inquiry established by it may. And then there's a whole new provision around a committee of inquiry. So in addition to the power to investigate, it's now a power to establish a committee of inquiry.
Okay, let's go through this. So we started with nine.
Yes, that's correct. What we're simply saying, Chairperson, is that the provision in 9 is already catered for in 38, 1 and 2 in the Principal Act. If you look at the Principal Act, it says that the board may, or in this case the proposal is to amend it to the regulator may, and upon receipt of a directive from the minister must investigate any railway occurrence.
Let us get to the text of the Principal Act. So we're looking at 38. So that's what you were reading. 38. Well, the board may, and upon receipt of a directive, the Prime Minister must investigate any railway occurrence for the purpose of preventing similar things. Don't like
mine. The difficulty that we're really raising is that the investigation that is conducted under subsection 9 may in fact influence the investigation that the operator is conducting under 8. And what we're really proposing is to separate out the investigation so that the obligation is on the operator in the first instance to investigate. And we're suggesting that our obligation is then also to provide a report to the regulator within a defined period of the outcome of that investigation. Only if the regulator is not satisfied with the outcome of that investigation would the regulator then proceed with its own investigation. We're concerned that if we've got two investigations running concurrently, that one might have undue influence or inappropriate overlap between the two exercises. And we think that the onus in the first instance should be on the operator to do the investigation thoroughly and properly and submit its report to the regulator.
Okay. My assumption was that originally that nine was put in there because the Transnational Rail and the Corporation fulfill the requirements of state without being asked. There might be situations where but your point is valid. In other words, you need to harmonize 8 and 9 better than that part, because that could then lead to infringement.
If I may,
Chairperson,
yes, you may recall that in the last portfolio committee meeting where the issue was deliberated, and subsequent to that, then we had come up with different methods to today. Nine, we agree, I think we all agree that eight should remain, that the responsibility to be investigating for every occurrence lies with the operator and not with the RSR. And then after that one, we said that the operator must, upon request, send a investigation report to the regulator on completion of the investigation. Okay. Now we don't want to be receiving each and every investigation report, but we will request.
Okay.
Then.
Can I go slowly? So eight stays. And then nine gets changed.
What nine just says is that the operator, the regulator may require the operator.
Okay, the regulator may require,
the operator to assess the impact of the recommendation made in May require the operator to assess the impact. Of the recommendation. Made in operator's occurrence investigation report. In order to effect safety improvement. So what we have done is that we said we will not required
safety and more improved
safety improvement. So 9 is basically going away. We will not be issuing directives to operators to reinvestigate, or we will not be issuing directives to them to conduct investigation in a particular manner. They will go ahead and conduct their own investigation. But when we receive those investigation reports, we also want to be questioning operators on the recommendations that have been that are in the investigation report.
So that's the totality now of the new 9 that you're proposing.
Yes, but again,
the
regulation also
may require, yeah.
Yes, the other thing, the 38 one that we referred to in the current legislation, then will follow that to say the regulator may, or upon receipt of the directive from the minister, investigate any regular occurrence. What I do not agree with now, which you raised now, is that the two investigations, the investigation should not go on concurrently.
And that was a separate one.
Yes,
in other words, the impression, which I don't think was intended, but could be created, was that what eight refers to and what 9 refers to would be two different investigations. Whereas what I always understood 9 to be is they must do it, the operator, but they didn't do it, so you are empowered to issue a direct, which is redundant, which is eight really empowered to do.
It's a requirement.
No, actually, 9 was meant to say we may issue a directive to say to influence how they should be done, how those investigations should be done. But now we are taking that away. We say, okay, you will do your investigation, give us a report, and then we will comment on the report that you have given us.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
That's fine. Yeah, I think we're all happy with that. But you were saying something about 1 again. You wanted to change something in the
I think what if I heard you correctly, that the investigation, the RSR should wait for the operator to first complete its investigation before it can conduct its own investigation. Oh, okay.
Chairperson, it's something else. Remember, we didn't know this about this agreement and this amendment.
Okay.
On the present one, what we proposed,
we thought it would be two.
Yeah.
We said 8, take away all the influencing of the 8, subsection 8 investigation, and instead of the current 9, put then in that they must submit the outcome or report on that investigation within a determined timeline. And then what we proposed, that if the regulators are satisfied with the outcome of that, they can use that as a trigger to trigger the subsection 1 independent investigation by the regulator itself. That is what we're proposing, and it captures this to some extent. That
okay, but as it stands now, with the current 1, they could be coming out of it.
They could be.
And I think we do want to allow for that.
Yes.
We do want to allow for that. We don't want to encourage that to happen, but there might be a pathetic operator that is really bad to deal with.
The understanding was that the pen of the FLD covering that is the agreement not satisfied about the investigation, whether the arm is not done. For any pathetic operator who is not capable of doing it, above in the internal kicking that the regulator can make the engagement of the investigation. That's what I'm understanding.
Yeah, but that was the other issue. So I think last week what we decided to stop in, and I think that's what we should be doing. What you don't want is if there's a weak investigation or whatever,
and
in the view, it might have been a good one, but in the view, it wasn't good, it didn't get the results they wanted. They order a reinvestigation. That's just going to produce the salt and irritation and so forth. If they're not satisfied, they have the power to then
reinvestigate.
And even if they are satisfied, they have the power to
do it.
Okay. So we're dropping 10. So let's just be clear
what
they're
bringing.
10,
11,
and 12. And 10, 11, and 12.
12, yeah. Effectively 9 too, Chair, because it's being amended so vastly. Yes.
Okay, then we get to the committee of inquiry.
I think that the issue of the inquiry basically was to allow the RFR to be able to subpoena witnesses. But really, it's not. We are not. I think maybe we may have used an incorrect way to say committee of inquiry. But here we are actually talking about the investigation. That when we conduct investigations, then we want to conduct formal investigations and constitute a board of inquiry. That we may subpoena witnesses who may not want to come when invited to come and give evidence.
Would it be possible to adopt the notion of a committee of inquiry just to avoid the confusion and allow those powers to, or those functions to be performed as part of the investigation by the regulators?
Yeah.
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 So we
propose that I think certain just be rewritten because 381 in the original act says when the RSR or by the Minister Director Boone in the investigation. So this portion belongs to that 381.
Yes.
That we reincorporate from 381 as 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, or whatever. Then it belongs in the area of the document.
What? I'm not sure what
you're
exactly.
The 381 you access.
Yes. The board may.
The occurrence, the board, there's no RSR, may and upon the director or the sister on Mr. Mark investigate.
Yes.
This whole item 13 is when they do an investigation, they can subpoena somebody who should be.
Yes.
So this whole item 13 should belong under 38.1.1.2. Stop at 7 now. And actually 7, 67 includes some, well not directly, so but it includes the principle of that 13.
You agree? In effect, that's what we're suggesting, I think, because we're starting off by saying the operator shall investigate. That becomes 38.1. 38.2 becomes the new clause that was 9.
Mm.
Then we bring in that the regulator may investigate, and then all the rest of the stuff that's in 13, and together with what's currently in the Act, fit together.
Mm.
So there will be
yeah.
We might want to deal with how the rail safety regulator runs own investigation, and then how it deals with and operates with investigation. So we might just want to check, because the way it's ordered now, it's a question of ordering, and I think that's what we might want to bring up what is currently, whatever, 13, to bring it closer to where we're describing your investigation,
that's correct.
Your own investigation, and then drop down.
We believe that the proposal does that, operating first, and then regulator, and then these clauses 13 to follow, I think.
It doesn't quite, because we haven't dropped one. One is describing what you do.
But we've made that three.
Oh, that's the assumption, sorry.
Yes. The first one indicates what the operator must now investigate.
Right.
And then we're saying if we'd like the results of the investigation on request, and then one becomes three, I think.
Yeah, we have to
rearrange
all of it.
Okay, we'll see when it's there.
Yes.
We all know what we want, which is to keep the things a little bit so that we're not the stumble there. Okay, that's 10
things. Thank you very much. That brings us to the end of our.
Thank you for that.
The rationale behind the board being changed by the regulator, I mean, was that just for expediency or to get the thing done quicker, or how does it exclude them their accountability in terms of the role?
I think part of the reason was that we have a board that has the majority of the board members except for one, non-executive director. Now, for practical purposes, to place the responsibility on the regulator makes more sense than to have it as a responsibility of the board.
Yeah. So you don't have to wait for a board.
No, no.
Yes.
Okay, rail commission corporation. Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
I think a number of our concerns, Chairperson, have been covered by the presentation by Transnet. Secondly, we also had an opportunity to sneak in through a window in one of the meetings where we raised a number of our concerns. Right. Therefore, it's just a question of emphasis that we're going to be putting up here. But looking at our brief input, Chair, there are only two issues that I'm going to be dealing with, because the other section that deals with the issue of investigating the investigating the occurrence has been attended to
we raised last time.
Yeah. So the first one is the issue of the definition of the station search. Yes, that's the issue that we're raising here. Because our understanding is that when you talk a station, the way we view it, we view the station to include the approach to the station itself, the concourse, bridges, ticket office, and the commercial sector on the station itself, including your access egress through the TG examiner until the platform edge. That's the station. But the section itself here, as presented in the amendment bill, tend to include what we see as an intermodal system, where you've got buses, you've got taxis, you've got other commercial activities that are taking place outside the station itself. Currently, that area that we see as an intermodal system, that brings buses and taxis and commercial activities, we see it as an area that is the responsibility of the local authorities. Right? That is when we see local authorities coming in to build taxi ranks, to build bus ranks, to build outlet facilities for vendors. Therefore, that is included in what we call a contingency plan. We deal with those operators in those areas in terms of the contingency plan. But in terms of crowd control and management, that's not our responsibility. Our responsibility is within the operating tunnel, the station itself. Right? If you look at the Act as it stands, in Part 3, it talks about the non-railway affecting safety. That's the area which is non-railway, but it affects our safety in terms of the operating of the station itself and the operating tunnel. Therefore, we want that section 1, Chairperson, to be sort of looked at and be clearly defined, so that we understand that the station does not include the outside area, which is non-rail area that affects the tunnel. Therefore, we talk the station, which is an operating tunnel covering all those areas that have identified.
Let's look at the wording.
For the old station, I would like to reword it. I go back to the original actual definition of a station. That's XXD. Station means a railway station or a railway passenger terminal. That's in the old one. Now we just continue there, and then which may include. Now we can come to this one. May take away, because the first station is already at the station and the passenger terminal, and then it is reality. It's a thing for passengers to enter or leave the train, including passenger terminal and the passenger house. Now we said it may include facilities for passenger motor transfer or commercial activity, which is the non, what we refer to as the non-railway operational area. And that's it, that's the station. It means that exactly as you said, there's a railway, what do you call it? There's a railway portion to it, and then there's a non-railway portion. That's the way the access is written. So we just say station is a place where passengers basically are in here, and there's an operator, a railway operator portion, and it may include, because they have thousands of, not done, hundreds of stations, very small, and does not include basically the motor. It may include facilities for passenger, motor transfer, and commercial activity. So, that is the station.
But we pick up but excludes that part of the network running through the station.
Yeah, that's because that's the standard.
What you're proposing, can I read it again?
Yes.
Station means a facility for passengers to enter or leave a train, including a railway passenger terminal and a passenger hull,
and increase for the purposes of security and
environment.
Okay.
You start there, and the
and may include
facilities for passenger and motor transfer and commercial activities.
And go on, forming part of it.
And then you can just use the legislation for say, which refer to non-railway operations affecting the safety of
It may
include facilities of motor transport commercial activities which are the non-railway operation portion.
And you say that.
And you say it. You stop here, that's it. You don't need to do that.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Can we ask you to, I mean, I don't see, I see the challenge that we've got. Can we ask people to think it over rather than to rush?
My response would be, and we have talked about it, I don't have a problem with the may, because it doesn't apply everywhere. It's very difficult in this level of legislation to try and prescribe precisely how big and how far a station is. If you go downstairs here, where does that station begin and end? But we didn't want to find that we excluded the facilities. So if we have it may, as Stungus has suggested, as SRC has suggested, it's fine. I think that the decision needs to be made here about whether what's now been deleted includes for the purpose of security and cloud management, whether that's too limiting or whether that adds any value. And I think that should be what needs to be, the committee needs to decide.
What we're doing here is we're not allocating responsibility in the definition.
We're just trying to describe what it's about.
What we're saying is what falls under the potential purview of a rail safety regulator.
And
in other words,
under the
stations are part of what we've got to look at. That falls under your purview. So. We're not going to be there, because we're not going to blame you for something that happened at a bus terminal which is managed by.
Extremely difficult to define, but each station has a different operation, whether you call it a bridge or a station, control data like error. So in the end, the logic was that there is an operation error, which the operator has to define and manage and put systems in place, whether it's your own safety system or an interface system, like the quality of the error. So we've made a distinction of your rail area, your rail operation, and your non-rail operation. And now, by lacking a definition of both proposed, we need to play with the other system and all that is involved. And we want to have one of the things that we have. Because it's not the other definition. Once the definition is passed, remember now that the access takes a lot of it, and then we have thousands of standards which you already draft in the middle. It's different to what I tell you is already in the draft document. And it puts major responsibility and accountability. And it will change all the some standards in station to keep the business. And we have six other things to do.
Okay, I took it too wide, maybe, or opened the can of worms. And include for the purposes of security and crowd management, and may include. Would you have a problem with that?
I don't
you don't have a problem with may include, but concerned with your
suggestion.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that's what we said. It may include facilities for business, or it may include non-operation areas like motor transfer, contract, motor transfer facilities or commercial facilities. That's all it is.
But
there's a passenger portion that is your train or your rail operation, and you make a decision there's also a non-rail area.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's totally different management principles, it's different safety systems, different interface agreements or contingencies.
Mm-hmm.
And if you need to find some new graphics, you have to go to the area.
Yeah.
By doing it this way, you know, it's tribe and teach. So it's also the funny.
But the rail safety regulator has got to look at that interface.
Yeah, but it's written in the
act already. Exactly. So what's the problem? No, but what's the problem with the reading?
Yeah, we propose a different definition. Because we can include public safety to the security of the and at the same time issue that we try to eliminate or
security.
Yeah, it's never totally flexible, but we try to think and we separate it because it's different management things that it continues. In crowd management, whether it's in your operation area or outside, crowd management is a principle. What is crowd management facing the community? Nothing, facing the community. What are those areas, other spaces? Crowd management, security, safety, they're putting things into it, too relevant to it.
You won't get to move on for the purpose of
it doesn't have to be in, but it was just saying that the House and this committee were very sensitive about safety and security issues, and the bill makes provision for us to take those into account. But a strict definition does not have to say those things. So we're just saying a station is this place and it includes commercial and things. That's the definition. The fact that they've got to manage I'm not disagreeing with you.
Mm.
The chairman wanted to say, the chairman said, are we leaving or are we...
The crowd control.
I think the chair said, can we leave it this or do we want to go in words with it? I'm just reacting to say,
yeah,
we can leave that sentence out if this committee is satisfied that in fact we're not detracting from the intent, the overall intent. And I'm tending to go towards the thing and say, I think you used the word, the definition is to say, what is a station? What it gets used for and how you manage it is a secondary issue.
So can we agree to something like this? Station means a facility for passengers to enter or leave a train, including a railway passenger terminal,
or
and more passengers. And may include facilities for passenger modal transfer and commercial activity.
Yes, yeah, that's defining a station.
And then we're happy with that.
Yes.
And then we're not going to do that.
Yes.
Except for, but exclude that part of the network running through the station.
That's,
yes.
That must stay it.
Yeah, that can stay it. No problem.
For the other
network.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because this is an area that affects safety, and that affects the safety of rail operators, so
yeah,
therefore it needs to be under their purview. But it's not a defining feature of a station.
No.
No.
It's
therefore it doesn't belong in
but
it.
But it was our intention to qualify so that, right, incorrectly as we've now shown.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't what defines a station, but that's why we're interested in the station environment as a rail safety regulator.
Yes.
Boarding. That interface between crowds and boarding and disembarking and so on is a safety issue.
Yes.
That needs to proper allowance for that. Okay.
And
like,
after, if I may.
Like that station where the journalist was killed, actually, where there's a bend and a
right.
Mm.
another follow up.
Yeah.
Now that particular person has been deleted, how is that particular position accommodated? Where are you accommodating if ever it was important?
In the regulations for the safety management system, provision is made for the reporting of occurrences and the management of occurrences, and we've split in the amendment to a standard for the safety management system, which is currently under review at the moment, safety issues, operational safety issues, the running of trains issues, from security issues, security reportable issues. And one of the elements is crowd control. So we will now, the operator has to have a process in place to manage that and demonstrate and give us statistics where he has evidence or incidents involving crowds. And it goes, oh, we've got the 9 different subsections within the whole security environment that we've now amplified in our safety management system standard and regulations that will be amended in the next little while. So we address it there as an operational issue.
Because a lot of the problems are.
Yes. And we are conscious of it, Chair, and we have amplified in the current standard. We have one item called security-related matters. It's now 9. So we have recognized the difference between personal safety and personal, which is security, and those security-related matters that impact on operational safety. And we've defined them more specifically than at the moment.
Okay. Thank
you. Yes. Yes, lastly from us, Chair, is the amendment of Section 17. I think we've had a healthy discussion on the issue of fees,
yes,
and we agree with all the changes that have been taken, that have taken place. Right, but let's say that right from the beginning we did not have a problem with that area, but the only fees. Let's support the changes that have been implemented. We only want to refer here, Chairperson, to subsection 1C that deals with the donation. We do understand that from time to time, the safety regulator will request, you know, for donation from ourselves. But for the sake of, you know, development of standards, sometimes they also, you know, request our employees to be sitting in some of the committees to develop those standards. Therefore, those donations are essential. We don't have a problem with that. But we want to propose that this be amended, Chairperson, to provide for the approval of the board instead of the minister. So that these requests, you know, they keep on coming on an ongoing basis instead of troubling the minister with all these minor issues that the board itself is responsible. That's what we propose on that country.
We agree with the proposed amendment. We have a proposal to say the donation or contributions received by the regulator with the approval of the board after consultation with the minister.
Okay, anything else?
Yeah, that's about all from our side, Chair. Since Section 38 has been dealt with, and we are hit with all those changes, I'm not going to bother you about that.
Okay, now do we need to come back tomorrow?
Could we just clarify the process from here? Perhaps if there's a new draft that we could be given an opportunity to have a look at and give further comments on, we'd be very happy with that.
I think we all need to. Yes.
Because there's been a lot of changes.
We need to look at it in my but I'm wondering whether it's worth all of us coming back tomorrow for that. Particularly if we're going to might well still get a doubt that we might still get one or two substantive comments from other parties. So should we look then at coming together again
and we'll schedule a date, but it would be late July. Sorry for that. But then what we will do is between the department, Adam, and the state law advisor, we'll put together then a new draft. Can we do that? And number it so that we don't get lost in the process. We'll try to take into account all of this, and hopefully that will be the basis then of us proceeding to a finalization. I foresee two more sessions. One is to look at what we've got, to see whether there are any other inputs or other potential stakeholders, and then a formalization mode. And hopefully we can move quite quickly, because I think these are like the key stakeholders we're moving in the center. Obviously, everyone needs to consult with their principals. We don't want to keep that as well. And a little bit of circulation
can I ask a protocol or procedural issue? Since this is lying now at this level, are we allowed to talk within ourselves and
absolutely
come up with a common
absolutely
understanding?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I don't know whether you're allowed or not, but absolutely.
Thank you.
I'm the wrong person to ask about protocol.
No, but that's wonderful.
Obviously.
Now
that's what we want to do.
Sure.
That's what we call it, the elemental state. Yeah, no, absolutely. It's to build relationships.
Yeah.
Because it's about building rails.
Yeah.
That's what it is. It's about.
No.
It's
not to walk.
That's it.
No,
no, no, that's why. No, no, that's a fight. You want to fight.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks to everyone. So we won't meet them tomorrow. But we have to schedule a further hearing. Am I right? We've got minutes at this time. No, they can't. They ask for more time. And then the union's more time takes us up into our recess. So they'll table it tomorrow. But let's give ourselves a couple of minutes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.